Fishermen need to realize that the wind is not your enemy, it's your friend, because it positions fish.
Time for the Angler Within podcast with Roy Bilby.
When's the last time you went to an auction, Roy?
I go to a gun auction occasionally, and the last time I went to that was, oh, good grief, probably 4 months ago when I bought a pump 410 shotgun in pristine condition for my grandson for when he's old enough.
Mm-hmm.
This thing is in pristine condition. Why? Have you been to an auction
recently? I just went to an auction this past week. On Tuesday, there was a local who had passed away, and he was a hoarder of everything fishing. Did not really fish himself, but
he didn't fish.
He primarily, you know, he didn't fish at all.
What's he doing, hoard?
He had lots of money.
Hoarding fishing stuff.
I
refer to it as my inventory. You've seen my basement. Do I hoard fishing stuff?
You know, Hold on. Well, I'll answer that question.
I saw you hesitate.
I will answer the question. It depends on how you're thinking about it and how you're looking at it. And I will say this. You keep a supply of stuff those are your go-tos that you keep on the wall. You use those for work. You're working. You're in your retirement. You're a pro fisherman. So those are what you need for work, right? So you need to have access to them quickly, and you need to keep them as we have as much stuff as you do. You have to put it on a pegboard, because I have piles and piles of packages of plastics, and I got to get a pegboard or something for mine, because for jig heads, I keep them in the bags, and you know what I mean? I don't have it all out with me. You can't take it all out with you. So you have to keep it somewhere. You have a large collection of stuff. Are you a hoarder? I didn't see the inside of your refrigerator. I can tell if someone's a hoarder by their fridge. Do you hoard fishing? Let me tell you this. This guy was a hoarder primarily of fly fishing equipment. And I know that we primarily talk about bass fishing on this podcast.
Well, that's right in your
wheelhouse. But we can dabble into this for a minute. Right. So he hoarded fly fishing gear. When I heard about it, I was told a story about him having so much stuff and stored away in different places. He had an empty freezer, like a refrigerator, and like the top half of the refrigerator was filled to the brim just with reels still in the boxes, never used.
Well, see, mine are in a clear tote so I can see what I got.
Okay, well, fine. But like, he had stuff everywhere, his point is. And he never fly fished a day in his life and just collected all his stuff. We'll put it this way. A G Loomis surf casting rod went for $35.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
A G Loomis. You probably can't buy the G Loomis reel seat for that.
I was bidding on it for a split second. I don't really have a need for a surf casting rod. I don't go after salmon either with that stuff. So I don't really need that.
But you're thinking, but it's G Loomis and that's G.
Oh, exactly. No, I know. So that's what I had caught wind about the sale, and I got in there and I got a hold of some really nice stuff, a box of poppers. I counted them. There's 37 painted and tied beautiful wood body poppers of all different sizes in this big box. You know, I paid 30 for that. You know, that was those go from anywhere to, you know, $5 to $10 a piece that were in there.
You save money there.
A nice tying vise for 30. That one goes for $249 on eBay.
$250 for this vise, and you bought it for how much?
$30.
What condition is it in?
It never been used.
Oh my god!
Was in the box with all the wrapping was on it, everything else. Yeah, it's a rotary. It's an anvil.
Please tell me, because I wasn't there. Please tell me this guy did not have bass fishing gear.
He did not.
I feel better.
Well, not there. He was primarily fly fishing stuff.
Fly fishing, which is what you do, right?
But there was. I do both. I'm biangular. Yeah. I'm a biangler. I fly fish and I bass fish.
The term is multi-species. Bi-angler. You just coined the new term.
I'm a bi-angler. That's it. That's it. Let's not get crazy.
You're going
here.
To see that in print 2 years down the road.
I know,
and go,
I know.
Hey, I coined that.
Yeah, but for all you bi-angler, well, what I mean by that, you say multi-species, but it's two different types of fishing. I fly fish, and I also use, you know,
casting gear, rods and bait casters.
Right, I got all of it. Which also point is, I'm starting to fill up a lot of space. I sent you a picture of my rods that are hanging from the ceiling now.
Yeah, yep, we're creating a monster. But hey,
and
you qualify as a bi-angler. I don't fly fish, so I'm strictly a multi-species. You are both, my friend, because you are a bi-angler. I like that.
So anyway, point is, for all you folks out there, check out your local auction houses. These smaller ones, these, you know, mom and pops, they get all kinds of different stuff through them. But if the right person puts their estate out there or a clean out, and you can score.
You never know what you're going to find.
No.
And you walked into it.
Well, I knew it was there. I had looked at it during the week. But
okay.
But it's on the corner. It's less than a mile from where I live. It's dangerously close.
But
I probably
never thought it would go for what it did.
No. And so, here's the thing, Roy. I was only there to go after those poppers and this, I sent you a picture of the framed bass thing with a couple of very famous flies with the print, you know, and the flies that were in it. Bob Clouser originally tied, Clouser minnow, which is a staple fly for saltwater. And he signed a piece of paper under it, and he signed the COA that he had tied it. And then this other guy, I forget his name, but he tied a bucktail frog. And so as far as bass fishing with a fly rod, those were the main go-tos. And it was a nice shadow box done up, you know, went in there for that. And I got into a bidding war with the guy in the front over that piece. But I was only there for that. I walked out of there with a pass load gas framing nailer.
Yeah.
$25. I don't frame houses. But
yeah,
I
don't
do sell.
Tell me he had tools because I but use I tools, do, but I own hammers.
But I do sell things. You don't have a pass load? You must
I do
have
not.
A pass load. Really?
See, I was putting up Morton buildings. I was a crew foreman. I worked for the company for 20 years, from 1982 to 2002. And we only got into the pass loads of the last bit of that 20-year run.
Game changer.
I was swinging hammer when men were men.
Well,
okay?
Listen, but what do you think of the pass load? What do you think of that?
Pass load.
What do you think of it, though? It's a heck of a tool.
Pass load is probably the best name out there.
You know,
Bostrich is good too, but Pazload, we use those towards the end. I was against it. We used ring shank nails.
Why were you
everything.
Against it? Because you fight change, tooth and nail.
Yeah, mostly nail.
That's exactly what it was.
We don't want to talk about construction.
No.
What I want to talk about is where I was the last few days. I went to one of my favorite bodies of water at Seago Lake, because I got a buddy that's got a camp there, and a family camp. It's been there for three generations. We usually go in the summer for a couple days, spend the night when nobody's at the camp. But I never made it over there this year. But he's had me come over the last few years so that he doesn't have a launch anywhere near his camp. It's way up the lake at a motel place where they let people put in. When he goes to pull his boat out, I usually come over and we'll fish a day. This time, because I wasn't there over the summer, we went yesterday in the afternoon and fished 3 hours before dark. And we put 25 fish in the boat once we figured out what to do. And then we went back today. This morning, we stayed overnight and we fished 3 hours this morning and only picked up five small fish. The bite had gone way south. The wind was changing direction every 15 minutes. And he drove his boat and trailer up to the motel, and I ran the boat up the lake and drove it on the trailer for him, and we pulled this boat out. But I want to talk about something I've mentioned a few times called circles of awareness, because if you can gain circles of awareness, it will help you with your fishing. And what I'm talking about is the guys that notice things that other people don't necessarily pick up on, but they're recognizing them as being, if they can apply to what they see, if they can apply their approach to it, it could be advantageous in many, many situations. I talk about circles of awareness because when we started, I mean, I got the perfect illustration from yesterday. This is my most current one. When we first got on the water, started fishing, it was only a few hours before dusk. So we went to one of the stretches that usually produces for us that time of evening. And my buddy's starting to get bites right off the bat. He's missing fish, but he's hooking a few. And I'm using things that typically work on this lake, and they're completely getting it. I haven't even had a contact yet, and he's put three fish in the boat. So I just, when he pulls in to make another cast, I observe that he's throwing a tube. Now, I had thrown a tube also, and my grub, and I threw a jerk bait, and I'm a crankbait, and this stuff always works, but they're ignoring it. And I turned to him and I said, "Are you throwing that Max Scent tube again?" He said, "Yep, that's what I've been throwing here all summer." I was throwing a Strike King Bitsy tube, which typically works great, but it doesn't have Max Scent, which is a product made by Berkley. The Max Scent stuff is incredible, people. If you haven't tried any of the Berkley Max Scent baits, do yourself a favor and get you some and get them in the water, because what the Berkley engineers did with this stuff is off the charts productive. To illustrate and quantify what I'm telling you, I did not have any of the Max Scent tubes. What I did have with me, because this is his boat, so I just threw a couple quick boxes together and took them on the fly. I packed light, but I did have Max Scent flatworms and a package of Green Pumpkin Max Scent hitworms. So what I did is I took the front half of a hitworm, cut it with scissors, and made a 2.5-inch Ned rig out of it and put it on an 1/8-ounce jig head. And this is the honest truth, everybody. My first three casts, I hooked up. And suddenly we're even Steven. And the only thing I did was note that he was throwing Max Scent and I wasn't. And it turned the night around. By the time we were done, I had 13 fish. He had 12. We caught 25, and I mean, we stayed pretty even after that, but I stayed married to that Max Scent all night. I tried a couple other products just to see, and I could not get bit. Every fish came on that Max Scent. And what turned my night around was observing that he was throwing, I saw him throwing a tube. I'm throwing a tube too, but I know he's been getting into that Max Scent this year. And I know what a difference it can make. I made the switch and it turned my night around. And that goes to circles of awareness. Sometimes that can be as simple as observing what your buddy's doing and making the necessary adjustments. We were both throwing a tube. His was Max Scent. Mine was not. When I switched to that, changed everything. That's the most recent example. But just a couple weeks ago, I was on a lake where I actually caught my 1,000th bass for the year. And again, that's 19 consecutive years I've been able to break 1,000 bass within a calendar year.
Congratulations.
And, I'm real proud of that.
Look at you.
But I work at it. I've got 102 entries in my journal for the year so far. And when I caught that number 1,000, that was my 98th entry in the journal for the year. So I'm out there a lot and I work diligently at it. And not all those trips are bass trips. I do a lot of targeting perch in the spring, and then I make specific crappie and bluegill trips for the freezer, because I may not be a biangler, but I am a multi-species angler.
Biangular.
That was for you. And all the other bianglers out there, I respect that. I just can't take time to fly fish. I got to be standing on my deck, flinging a bait caster.
Would you let me take you out fly fishing?
To be quite frank, I would be horrible at it.
That wasn't what I asked you. I didn't ask you if you'd be good at it. I said, would you go with me?
Rod.
I'll take you. You've taken me out on your boat, and you taught me a lot of stuff. Let me make you little bit more comfortable with a fly rod in your hand. And I'll tell you what we'll do. Yeah. We'll go popping for bass, and you will have
That's what I used to do.
Right.
When I was 17, 18, spent 2 years trying, but I bought a cheap outfit from a hardware store because I wasn't sure I'd be any good at it. And the equipment worked against me.
Yeah.
Same as I talked about starting out with a baitcaster, right?
Yeah.
But I was 17 or 18 years old. I didn't know what I know now. And I just figured, all fly rods are the same. And they're not.
No.
Just like anything
no,
else.
No, and especially, you know, the way that they flight them out, that's what I call it. You know, if you look at Orvis, you know, they stage it. There's an entry level, and you keep on going up, 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 up as far as the quality. You know, I jumped from a...
And what you can afford.
I was on the second rung, and I jumped up to, like, I went from a Clearwater to a Recon. And the Recon, which is like that's a $600 rod. That thing, I was using it tonight. I mean, I didn't catch any fish, but I am Superman with that thing. I mean, I'm like, look at this. It does make all the difference. My dad used to always tell me that it's the Indian, not the arrow. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I think it's both. He wouldn't let me have new golf clubs. I wanted a new set of, like, nice clubs. My mom told me it was because he didn't want to lose to me. That was why he kept me playing with, like,
there's
knockoffs.
Probably a lot of truth in that.
There was a ton of truth in it, and I didn't believe her. I was like, really? She's like, no, seriously, he did not like to lose. He didn't want you beating
him. She's like, listen to me. I know your dad, okay?
So
what I'm telling you is the truth.
I didn't get a decent set of clubs until he paid for a set that I got when I was in college. But that was because I found him and it was super cheap for it. There was a guy, a spoiled brat from Long Island. Quick story. Spoiled brat from Long Island had a bad round, threw a set of Titleist DCI 990s at me. That was a $850 set of irons back in 2000. That's when that was. And I got them for $150. So yeah, my dad put the money in my account. He's like, buy those. So I got them. But until that point, he kept me playing with, you know, like
garbage.
Yeah. Northeasterns or whatever the hell I was using. Top flights. You know, they were all like, meanwhile, he's got Callaways, you know?
Yeah.
No chance. Yep. No chance did I ever have against him with those clubs.
Yeah. It goes to equipment. So we'll do that. You give it, put a good fly rod in my hand. I just got tired of ripping my hat off my head on my last roll cast. You know, I'm like, this is dangerous. This is scary. I'll do something simple like a bait caster. So my second example, I'm fishing this lake. It was the day I broke 1,000, and I'm out there with this guy in a boat, and we're fishing. We migrated down to a shallow flat, and we know there's a couple submerged rock piles, and you can usually pick a few fish off of those. We know where the submerged piles are. I'm flinging my spinner bait. He's throwing a rooster tail. And while we're casting around these rock piles, we see a group of bait fish just scatter across the surface. They just bust out of the water scattering. And I cranked in as quick as I could and fired a cast over there. I said, something's chasing them. Throw your bait in there. And we both hooked up. And I got one that was like 3 pounds. He had one that was like 3 1/4. And we just, those bait fish kept blowing up all over that pocket. And we just kept, you could tell which way that school of bass was moving those bait by watching the surface. And we capitalized on it. And we loaded the boat. We caught a bunch of fish that day. I've been fishing with this guy on that lake for about 4 years now. I only go out 2, possibly 3 times a year. This was the first time I've been there this year, and it was the very beginning of October, and I just hadn't got there this year, although we did do a striper trip together, me and this guy, and we had the best day we've ever had on his lake, and a lot of those fish that were on our counters that day came from that shallow pocket where we were watching those bait fish blow up. I mean, we fished there about 45 minutes until they shut down and there was no more activity. We continued to cast around, but the bite was over. We then proceeded to work our way around the lake. But before we left, we went back to check that spot maybe 3 hours later. And lo and behold, bait fish were blowing up all over the place again. I said, good grief, they never left this spot. They just shut down for a time. And we picked up maybe 10, 12 more before they shut down again. And we called it a day. But it goes to circles of awareness. We noticed the bait fish breaking on a being pushed to the surface, and I immediately told them something's chasing them, and we fired in there and we hooked into a double, and it was game on. And I've been in the boat with people where that's happened, and they saw it and it did not even register. And I always fire a cast in there because the fish just revealed their location. You know, you're not broadcasting to find them. That they're right there. They just showed you where they are. And if you've got your circles of awareness about you, you recognize that the opportunity it presents and are in position to capitalize on it. Another thing that I see a lot, it just doesn't register with them. You're having a good day. You're getting some bites. The bite just isn't as good as it could be or should be as far as you're concerned. You know, why aren't they biting? It's just not happening today. We're getting some, but we usually get a lot more than this. And all of a sudden the wind changes and you notice that the leaves on most of the trees are flipped over. Now that doesn't happen just because there's a breeze. When the wind blows, the leaves don't automatically flip over, but they do flip over and turn bottom side up when there's an approaching front. And typically, I mean, I used to work with a guy that we had a lot of outside projects to do. This was after the construction company, and half our work was outside when I'm working with this guy. And I'm like, we better not do that today. The leaves are flipping up. And he goes, yeah, so I said, it's going to rain. And he's like, how do you know that? I said, when the leaves flip up, bottom up on the trees, it's an approaching front. It's going to rain. He goes, there's no rain in the forecast today. I said, I don't care if there is or not. I'm telling you, it's going to rain.
This is before you can pull up the phone and look at a radar.
Well, there's a few clouds moving in, but it's not in the forecast. I said, let's just give it some time. 45 minutes later, it's pouring. And he's like, does that always happen? I said, yeah, Ken, it always happens. That's and my theory, I don't know the scientific principle behind that, but I know I've recognized it an awful lot of times, and it always means rain or a front is approaching. It could miss you, but if the leaves are flipped over where you are, it's headed right for you, I think. And my theory has always been it's the drop in barometric pressure.
Now, can I say something?
Go ahead.
I would say also, though, I've seen the leaves flip when it was just a hot afternoon. It's pressure, yes, but I've had it happen where there was no storm, no nothing that would happen for maybe a day or two after when the leaves are turning over. Have you seen that as well? You ever seen it before?
Not that I recall, because if it didn't rain, I probably just didn't make note of it. But I... when I'm fishing,
you're a fair weather watcher of leaves turning over.
when I'm fishing, and sometimes when I'm working, if I see the leaves flip, it's an approaching front. That's what I've seen.
Hey,
my theory is it's the barometric pressure. I don't know if the top side of the leaves is heavier and the bottom is lighter, just like the warm air rises and warm water rises. I don't know. I always felt barometric pressure had some bearing on that.
My back's bugging me. So I'm sitting in the recliner with I just attached the mic onto the arm of my chair.
Okay.
So I'm reclined right now talking to you. That's why you can't see me.
Well, I hope somebody else is reclining as they listen. But here's another thing.
This is nice though, by the way. You should do this.
Four circles of awareness. A shift in the wind. A change in the wind. If you're fishing a shoreline and you suddenly the wind switches and starts blowing the opposite way, if you're paying attention to that, due to circles of awareness, head to the bank that the wind is now blowing in on. And the reason I say that is fish are generally active, most active, on the banks that the wind is blowing into. And people always assumed it was, and here's another misunderstanding with a lot of fishing. People always assumed it was because, you know, the wind is heavy, so the bait fish are getting blown in on shore. That's not true at all. What they feed on, the plankton, is getting blown into shore. The bait fish follow their food, just like walleye, bass, trout, other game fish follow their food. So when the bait fish follows their food into that windblown bank, you got bass right behind them following the bait. And if you're paying attention to what goes on around you, which is what circles of awareness is all about, pay attention to which bank the wind's blowing in on and go there and throw some moving baits that mimic bait fish, like a spinner bait, like a crank bait, like a jerk bait, like an umbrella rig, anything that simulates bait fish, throw it on those windblown banks and you will up your odds for catching fish because that's where they're feeding. Yeah, it's a pain in the neck to fish in the wind, but fishermen need to realize that the wind is not your enemy. It's your friend because it positions fish. And windblown banks are always a great place to start. You just have to deal with the wind. But remember, if you use it to your advantage, it can be your best friend, not your worst enemy. And these are moderate winds, okay? Now, we've talked about shade pockets in the past and just small shade pockets, narrow shade pockets on a sunny, bright, sunny day can be a strike zone. I'm talking underneath docks, underneath fallen trees, the shady side of a laydown on a bank can hold fish. Fish should already be on a laydown, but if it's a bright sunny day, put on your circles of awareness. Try the shady side of that laydown first. That's where the bass are going to be because that's an ambush point, not right out on the sunny side in the wide open where everything they want to ambush can see them too. They're going to lurk in the shadows. So keep your wits about you, pay attention to your surroundings, and always fish the shady side of laydowns and docks and boats and slips, stuff like that. Fish the shady side first if you're out there in the middle of the day when it's bright and sunny and you have no cloud cover. Again, you will swing the odds. You'll sway the pendulum of success in your favor because you're using what you know about fish behavior to increase the odds of getting a strike on your cast. There was a tournament, and this goes to paying attention to minor details, and I credit my tournament partner of 14 years, Ryan Coulter, for spotting this. We had a tournament on a lake, a lot of pontoon boats on this lake, and no kidding, this is going back probably 20 years, but we fished a lake. It's got a ton of pontoon boats. We're going down a dock line, and it's like, every other dock has got pontoons on it. But there was this one area where there was like four pontoon boats in a row. He refined a pattern where he's like, look at, he said, I just caught the last two fish doing the exact same thing. He said, I've never done this before, but look at the pontoons. Look at them, Roy. He said, see that? See the third one? See how scummy those pontoons are? I said, yeah. He's like, that boat hasn't moved all summer. It's got a huge scum line on that. And he was taking, you know, buildup from being in the water and being sedentary and not moving, being stationary. And it starts to grow this stuff that bait fish feed on. And we've talked about the food chain. There's bass. The bass were laying underneath those scummiest pontoon boats. And we were taking a black and blue Stanley jig with a trailer on it and pitching it to the lower units of the outboards hanging down below those pontoons. And that's how we limited out. Not making it up. That actually happened. And his circles of awareness were spot on. He noticed that those scummiest pontoons were the ones where he was getting bit. The other ones weren't. So we just went down that whole shoreline looking for pontoon boats that hadn't moved all summer. And we consistently, that particular day, caught bass off the lower units of the outboards and skipping a jig along the side of the pontoons without hitting them and making a loud clank. Because if you did that, you didn't get bit. You had to be precise in your casting. But those were the pontoon boats that held the most fish. So the bass were where the bait was. And he recognized that, clued me in, and that's how we got our limit in that tournament. It was crazy. So that's a minute detail, but he had incredible circles of awareness, and I learned a ton fishing with him. So, Ryan, man, if you're listening, I learned so much from you, and miss all the time we spent on the water. Here's another example from, good grief, had to be 25, maybe even 30 years ago. It was 30, because it was probably 92 or 93, so we're talking 30 years ago. Back in, I had my first aluminum bass boat, thought I was a big deal, entering tournaments way over my head with 140 boat fields and thinking I was going to win every tournament, and I spent a lot of time paying people very good money to fish against me, because they took my money every tournament. But I'm an optimist, and I entered every single tournament believing I could win. And if you're going to compete, that needs to be your mindset, regardless of your knowledge of the body of water. Go out there and do what you know, fish your strengths. But we're on this tournament on Lake Champlain 30 years, good grief, three decades ago. And here's where paying attention to your surroundings comes into play. We were fishing the lower end. What's the name of the town there? Whitehall. We launched out of Whitehall, and it's more a riverine environment down there. It's not, it's the narrowest part of the lake where it goes right down to a river. So, I mean, the whole thing is like fishing a river, and there's grass everywhere. We were fishing along, and there had been heavy torrential rains the day before. We went up and pre-fished the day before. You could do that. There was no rule against it. There was, good grief, the lake was covered with tournament boats the day before. We got a motel. We spent the day before pre-fishing the area around the launch. I didn't run far in those days because I didn't have a very big boat, but I was there to compete. And so we stayed right in Whitehall, and we fished in torrential downpours, and we caught some fish and had a plan for the next day. We start the tournament, and it's about 10 o'clock in the morning, and we're fishing all the places where we had found fish, and we're just not connecting until we got to this one area about 10 a.m. where there was a creek mouth. And as we're running up to that creek mouth, we noticed, you could see the watercolor change. Coming out of that tributary, there was a mud line. And you could see that mud line coming down all the way across, probably 200 yards out from that creek mouth, across the lake. And we got into that muddy water, and we decided to pull out and get down lake from that, because the wind was coming down the lake. It was out of the north, and that mud line was creeping farther and farther south. And we just got within a cast length of it and threw across the face of it parallel, using it like an edge, like a shade line. And we limited out throwing spinner baits down the edge of that mud line where the clear water met the muddy water. And our guess was those fish were underneath that mud, right, moving down with that edge and darting out into that clear water where they could see our spinner baits going by. We limited out and culled and culled and culled the rest of the day, backing down the lake just ahead of that mud line because the fish were in it. And you'll read magazine articles where they talk about fishing mudlines and how they hold fish. They're not kidding, everybody. I've done it, and it is the real deal. So if you've had heavy rain a day or two before a tournament, go look for mudlines on the tributaries. They can be gold mines. There's another deal that happened, and this is my last example. This involves circles of awareness, but it involves electronics too, but knowing where fish are and where they aren't. There's a lake I fish. I'm not going to mention the name, but it's, this can happen anywhere. This is bass fishing 101. It's a pretty deep lake. It's got lake trout. It's got walleye. It's a two-tiered fishery. It's got cold water species and warm water species, like so many of them, just because of the depth. That holds the lake trout and the brown trout, but we fish it for the walleye, for the largemouth, the smallmouth, and all the other fish we like to chase. It's a multi-species fishery, and there are a lot of ledges where it drops right into deep water. And typically, I went there with a guy that I competed against for years, and we became friends, although competitors. But when we were not in a tournament situation, we always visited before the tournament and after the tournament, wished each other good luck. You know, if I can't get your money, I hope you get mine. You're the guy I want to win, if it's not me. That kind of deal. And we just had a lot of respect for each other. And he was really good on the Mohawk River, and I learned a lot fishing with him and against him. But I took him to this lake, and we fished together after the tournament. By that point, I had a big nitro with a 150, which was a big motor back in the late 90s. And he had a smaller boat, I think a 17 foot with a 70 horse outboard. That's what he had. And he was anxious to fish with me because I've never been in a real bass boat before, as he put it. And he said, don't hold back. Don't be afraid to run hard. And this particular was a TF 190 nitro, my second nitro. And we GPS'd it with a 150, no less, a Mercury Black Max doing 68 miles an hour on Saratoga Lake on GPS. With a GPS, we clocked it at 68. And when we stopped, I realized I didn't have the throttle completely pinned. But we had ideal conditions that day. Anyway, I took this guy. His name is Gene Colorito, tremendous friend of mine. Doesn't compete anymore. I ran him out on this lake, and we usually fish the flats in the fall of the year after the tournaments because the fish are shallow feeding up, and we could only get one or two little largemouth, smallmouth, I mean, just like pounders, just, you know, 12-inch bank runners. But I noticed, I said, there's another flat, and I would get off the flat so I could run. And every time I swung out just off those flats where it was deeper to run, I was marking a lot of fish in 30 and 35 feet. And I hit the second flat, and we got one little run. I don't even think it measured. We fished that for a half hour. Not happening here. Ran up to the next flat, and when I pulled out, I noticed 30, 35 feet. I'm marking a lot of fish. Don't know what they are, but I'm marking a lot of fish there. We go on the third flat, and it's not happening at all. So I said, look, every time I pull out, I'm noticing and marking a lot of fish on my electronics in 30 to 35 feet. They're not up on the flats. These ledges are right off these flats. These fish are close. I'm guessing these are the bass that we're not catching up on the flats. He says, well, I don't have anything. I don't fish that deep. I said, this was the 90s, okay? This is late 90s. This is before drop shotting was even a technique for us here in the U.S. It was popular in Japan, but nobody was doing it here. Or if they were, they weren't talking about it. So I have a bait, and this, you guys, you're going to want to Google. If you're not familiar with this, you're going to want to Google it and look it up. It's a tail spinner, and I don't know how many categories of lures that nomenclature fits, but a tail spinner, the particular one I used, Google the Man's Little George tail spinner. What, it's a very simple, basic lure, but it's for deep water. And you can catch them on shallow on it, but what it is, it's a half ounce. Well, they come in various weights, but I used a half ouncer. It's a half ounce egg-shaped flattened piece of lead that has a line tie on the top, a treble hook hanging off the bottom, and a shaft coming out the rear with a couple stainless steel beads and a single treble hook. And you can throw this thing, it casts like a bullet, because it basically is a half ounce lead bullet. You can fire it a mile and it drops fast. And the way I would fish it is I would fire a cast out there, and as soon as it hit, I would engage my reel and lift up so I could feel that blade spinning. I could feel the vibration of the blade, and I would drop it on a semi-slack, almost a tight line, all the way to the bottom. And it would, when it would hit bottom, you had to watch your line. When it hits bottom, your line would just sag and belly out. And then I would lift and drop. I'd snap it off the bottom about a foot and let it drop. Snap it off the bottom and let it drop. And every time you lifted it a foot, you would feel the vibration of that blade. Every time you did that. I told Gene, I said, this is called a tail spinner. I gave him one. I used one. I said, let's find out what those fish are down there. And my very first cast, he said, how do you fish this? I said, I'll show you. I fired out a cast and I engaged my reel and lifted up till I explained what I'm doing. I said, now I'm just letting it free fall. I said, watch my line. When it gets to the bottom, it'll belly out. And just as I said that, I felt a tick and I swung and locked up. And he saw my rod load. He goes, you got one? I said, yep, feels like a good one too. I said, sometimes it doesn't make it to the bottom. And the strikes is you'll just feel a very light tick because it's way down there. And again, back in those days, all I used was monofilament. That's what we used. They hadn't come out with fluorocarbon. They had not come out with any of these new braided lines, or if they had, they were brand new and I wasn't using them yet. I had mono on everything. And now the other way to work it, like I said, is a lift and drop. And sometimes at the top of your lift, before it makes it to the bottom, you'll feel that tick. Other times you'll just go to snap it and your rod loads up because a fish grabbed it and you didn't feel it. And that's called a tail spinner. A man's bait company, Little George Tail Spinner. He named it Tom Mann. When he created that bait, he named it after the governor. I think they were located in Louisiana. I may be wrong on that, but the governor's name was George something. He named it after the governor of the state where he had his company. I do know that. That's why it's called the Little George. But That's the tail spinner. That's how you fish it. It still catches fish. But the whole point of this is all I did was notice every time I swung out to run up to the next flat, I was marking fish in 30 to 35 feet. Because of a little thing called circles of awareness, I knew where the fish were not and I knew where they were. All we had to do was determine if they were the ones we were targeting, and they were. And we caught a bunch of fish that day, both of us, on those tail spinners. I went back to the flats we fished and we fished them in 30 to 35 feet. And all those fish we marked, we were able to consistently hook up with and catch because they were located right off of those flats. And I think that they were just moving up and down, and that day they were down. And he thanked me because he'd never been introduced to the tail spinner. He saw how effective it was for those deep fish, and it still works. So if you're not into drop shotting and you want to catch fish you're seeing deep, try a tail spinner. And that pretty much wraps it up. I mean, I could come up with other examples for circles of awareness, but that should suffice. So pay attention while you're out there. Pay attention to these little subtle clues. Be one of those guys that recognize what other people miss, and you will put more fish in the boat. I can promise you.
Put yourself into Roy's DMs, as always, at all lowercase Roy Bilby. He loves to hear from you. Have you heard from anybody recently?
Yes, I have. I want to give a shout out to my buddy Jamie he's an Instagrammer at anglersonly518. An interesting thing about my buddy Jamie is he happens to be buddies with Chat Sutliff, who was the guy I gave the shout out to in our last episode. And Jamie reached out to me because we started fishing together every October on a river together. He said, hey, we're due. It's October. When are we going to hit our spot? I said, how about this weekend? He said, that works. Since we're fishing about a, and this is a, a text he sent me. Since we're fishing about a month sooner than we usually do, do you have any lure recommendations? I listened to this week's episode of your podcast, and it was super insightful, and I'll be adding a few crankbaits and moving baits. So I supplemented that list with a few other things that I think will work right now, and it's basically everything I talked about for the early part of the fall transition. And we're gonna hit it and see how we do. But the way I met this guy, he did a post on Instagram, and this was several years after I'd been hooked up with Bass Pro Shops, and I only had the one store in Utica. You have no idea how many people see that. And he put out on his Instagram that he was on a quest to catch and release 500 bass in a year and see if he could do it. And I caught that on his Instagram. So I reached out to him and I said, hey, I saw that you're doing this. Looking at the pictures, it looks like you fish one of the same rivers that I fish a lot. And I just want you to know that counting fish and keeping track, that's going to make you a better fisherman. I do that every year and try to catch 1,000. I commend you for going after 500, and I'm going to enjoy following that journey on Instagram. To my surprise, and this blew me away, he messaged back, yeah, I saw you at Bass Pro Shops last year, and you talked about setting goals, and it inspired me to see if I could catch and release 500. I'm like, oh, so cool. I had no idea. And we started talking back and forth, and a year later, I said, we should fish together. We fish the same spots. And so we started connecting. We've done it for 3 or 4 years now, and he was at the Bass Pro Shops to see my presentation with Chad Sutliff. They used to be in a band together, and Chad's the drummer I talked about last episode, and I'll be fishing with Jamie day after tomorrow, and we'll see how we do. But I want to give out a shout out to Jamie because he's a great fisherman. He's been on a tear this year, and he had one day on that river where he banked 75 smallmouth just over 2 hours. He absolutely crushed him. So I'm going to have to be on my best game this weekend and see what we can do together. I'm looking forward to that. Just wanted to give a shout out to him, and thanks for listening. Glad you think it's insightful. That's all I want to do, is give my insights from 4 decades of writing this down to help everybody tap into their own personal angler within.